75 to 80% of these people are either drug addicted or mentally ill. There's no shortage of funds at the state or local level. Did you know that currently in the state today, there are 41 separate programs across 9 separate agencies spending $4 billion in the fiscal year ended June 30th to deal with homelessness, and the number just keeps going up. What we're doing isn't working. We need to change. We need to get treatment for the drug addicted. We need to get treatment for the mentally ill. We need to stop calling failure success.
That was former California Congressman Doug Osi at last night's recall election debate. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand. I host the Political Breakdown podcast at KCRW's sister station, KQED. Today, we're tackling Newsom's recall. Osi was one of four California Republican gubernatorial hopefuls who took the stage last night. In all, more than 40 people are vying to oust Governor Gavin Newsom on September 14th. That's recall election day. Mail-in ballots will be sent out in less than 2 weeks. Democrats had banked on the idea that an earlier election would work in Newsom's favor, that he'd ride ever-shrinking COVID cases, school reopenings, and a booming economy to an easy win. But while Newsom's approval rating is still hovering around 50%, according to the latest polls, it's not clear that the governor's Democratic base is fired up to come out and support him. And California's current outlook is considerably less rosy than it was just 2 months ago. LA and the Bay Area have reimposed mask mandates as the Delta variant drives cases back up, just as we enter what's expected to be the toughest months yet for fires, heat, and drought. The mood may be reminiscent of the political headwinds then-Governor Gray Davis faced when he was recalled from office in 2003. California was in the midst of rolling blackouts, an energy crisis, and a huge budget deficit, problems Republicans successfully pinned on Davis. But for now, Newsom remains in a much stronger position than Davis was 18 years ago, when his approval rating fell below 30%. Joining us to talk about the Newsom recall is Carla Marinucci. She's a senior writer for Politico's California Playbook and a former colleague of mine from our San Francisco Chronicle days. Hey, Carla.
Hey, Marisa. Good to be with you.
Glad you are here. Also with us is longtime Republican strategist Sean T. Walsh. Sean's consulted on the gubernatorial campaigns for Pete Wilson and that 2003 recall, Arnold Schwarzenegger. You might recall he won. But Sean's not advising any of the candidates in this race, right, Sean?
Correct.
Good to have you with us as well. Very happy to get a Republican point of view today.
Thank you.
So, Carla, I want to start with you. Talk about the overall tone of the debate last night, which maybe not everybody tuned into. Were the candidates going after Governor Newsom or one another or making the broader recall case, do you think?
It was a Gavin Newsom bash from start to finish. I thought that was one of the more interesting things about this. The Republicans really went by that Ronald Reagan 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican. They did not go after the front runner in this race on the Republican side, Larry Elder, the talk show host who wasn't there. They didn't really go after each other. That was kind of a win for the Republican Party. Look, these folks had to introduce themselves to millions of voters who still don't know who they are largely. So we got to see a little bit of that. But it was all about Gavin Newsom all the time, his performance on the COVID crisis, on crime, on homelessness. In that respect, they did what they needed to do. But Marisa, this was no Thrilla in Manila kind of call. There was not a lot of drama. It was held at the Nixon Library. There were a lot of very friendly questions, including a lot of sort of Republican-tinged questions about China and the fentanyl crisis, things that we don't normally sort of deal with in the California gubernatorial race. So I think the Republicans did hand Newsom and his team a lot of ammunition, and you saw that this morning and on social media. The Newsom team is already using some of their statements to say, hey, you want a governor that governs like Florida? You'd vote no on the recall. And that's how they're trying to fire up Democrats. So I think both Democrats and Republicans got something out of last night's debate.
Yeah. Well, Sean, let's bring you in here. I mean, as a Republican strategist, do you see the job of these candidates to bring voters to their side or just more to convince them to recall the governor? Because, you know, the chances of them winning become moot if more than 50% voters say they want to keep Newsom in office.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. A recall election is not an election. It's a two-part dance. The first is you have to convince the public that they need to fire a sitting governor. And so that's first and foremost. No Bucks, no Buck Rogers, no recall Governor Newsom. None of them have a chance. So they have to make that case first and foremost. And then second, they need to make the case that they are the alternative if they choose to fire the governor. So I think the way that they approached this last night was pretty typical. Number one. Number two, you know, the old saying, if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, that debate was pretty close to that. You had a few people walking the Appalachian Trail, but not a lot of people in California paying attention. So, you know, this is about positioning for fundraising. This is about trying to raise your profile a little bit going into the recall race.
I mean, right. There was at least three people watching us three, right?
Indeed.
All right. Well, you brought up John Cox. I want to play a cut from him from last night. Here is John Cox, a businessman who has run kind of perennial candidate for office, talking about the housing crisis.
The housing crisis is the most severe problem. We have a lot of them, but housing really is the most severe because it's driving businesses out of the state. It's driving people out of the state. Housing is my business. I build houses in other states for a tiny fraction of what it costs to do in California.
I mean, Carla, a lot of people would agree with him. Housing is a huge issue here, but I think, you know, Cox, who lost to Newsom in 2018, is sort of, I don't know, is he overpromising here? Because it's not like a governor can get into office and wave a magic wand and change local zoning laws and environmental laws.
Yeah, and that is exactly the problem for all of these Republican candidates. The question I think that needs to be put to them is, what immediately would you do as governor? What would you undo that Gavin Newsom has done in terms of executive orders, in terms of appointments? You saw Cox deal with that somewhat, saying basically, if I were elected governor, pretty much the Department of Motor Vehicles, Caltrans, and the Employment Development Department would be given a complete rundown. And he said there were plenty of people, no shortage of people that he would be firing. Cox has this problem. Yes, he lost to Newsom in a landslide in 2018. And let's remember, Newsom was elected in a landslide in 2018. Pretty much he is reprising that same campaign. I mean, I think he mentioned being a businessman multiple times last night. He doesn't have any elected experience. And yeah, he made a lot of promises. I'm going to audit every single department in the state and come up with the waste, fraud, and abuse. And Marisa, you've covered politics. How many times have we heard that promise?
He also promised to run legislative candidates, which would be difficult to do in the short, you know, year or so you would have before you're running for re-election, right? So Sean, I want to ask you about another candidate, Doug Osi. He is among the more conservative candidates on the stage, longtime former congressman from the Sacramento area. And he had this interesting moment when he promised, he said he would sit down with San Diego Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez if he's elected. For folks not familiar with Lorena Gonzalez, she's a progressive labor-aligned Democrat. She has the powerful Appropriations Committee in the Assembly. What did that tell you about Doug Osi, Sean, and sort of the case he's trying to make?
Well, it's insider ball, and I think hopefully Osi's trying to raise money from kind of insider business groups, et cetera. But, you know, Lorena Gonzalez is the most powerful Democrat in California. I don't want to offend Willie Brown, who I think is just an amazing human being, was a master in politics, but she's kind of the Willie Brown of the legislature now. So strong, so powerful, although she wields an iron fist. So if you're going to get anything done in Sacramento, you're going to have to work with Lorena Gonzalez.
Interesting. All right. Well, notably absent were two of the best known candidates. First, let's talk about Caitlyn Jenner, reality star, former Olympian. We'll move on to longtime conservative talk show host Larry Elder. Carla, Jenner's in Australia filming another reality show. Politico just reported this week that her campaign is in debt. She doesn't really seem to be campaigning. I mean, can we still call this a candidacy?
She has reduced herself to a footnote in this race, if that. When you leave for Australia to go to be on a reality show in the middle of a campaign, I think you've outlined your priorities to the voters of California. So at this point, we're told she's going to do a bus tour around the state. Well, right now, not a single major endorser has come forward in that race, and her campaign finances are underwater. So that's where we're at with her.
Larry Elder, Sean, is a different story. He's a late entrant to the race. He missed the debate because he was fundraising in Bakersfield. But the Larry Elder show has been a staple in LA talk radio for over two decades. He's polling very well. What do you think about his candidacy and, you know, some of the controversy we've heard over libertarian views, like the fact that the minimum wage should be $0 an hour?
Well, a couple things. Number one, I think this race originally got down to, is Caitlyn Jenner going to be the Arnold Schwarzenegger of this race? But it looks like she's turning into the Gary Coleman of the race. So with her out of the race, she had name identification. You've got Larry Elder, who has a lot of name identification. I think he's very attractive to Republicans because it puts forward an image that they want to see, which is more diversity. He's an African-American gentleman, longtime individual with a lot of name identification. So he doesn't have to spend $10 million to get his name identification. Now, people know him, unlike poor Doug Ose, unlike even in Mr. Cox, who ran in the last race. People don't know who he is. And Kevin Kiley, great guy, really, really smart. But Elder has hands and hands over any other candidate out there just on the name identification alone.
And as we kind of noted before, you only need a plurality in the second question if the recall is successful. So, Carla, let's get into what polling is showing, where we're at, a little over a month before this actual election day. We had two new polls out in recent weeks, far closer than it seemed it might have been just a month ago. An Emerson College poll found 48% of registered voters against the recall, 43% for it. How did we get here? This is a governor who had an approval rating of, over 60%, I think, early in the pandemic.
In many respects, those numbers are kind of jaw-dropping in a state that is overwhelmingly Democratic. On the other hand, I got to say, I think Democrats, particularly on Team Newsom, are not hitting the panic button yet, because just do the math. The Republicans in California lag behind Democrats by more than 20 points on voter registration. They are impassioned, and the polls are showing that. But no matter how many turn out, many Democrats think the math is just not there for them to get this recall over the line. As Sean said, a candidate like a Larry Elder may help their cause, especially in a big market like Los Angeles, where he has a huge radio market. But in some ways, too, Larry Elder has been a gift to the Gavin Newsom team. And you can see that on social media. They have identified him as the candidate. He is the front runner. And by becoming the front runner, they can now define who is opposing Gavin Newsom. And they can tie some of Larry Elder's more controversial statements, when they're mining his Twitter feed and his radio feed going back many years, tie him to Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, that whole Fox News crowd as that kind of Republican.
I think one of your colleagues tweeted that there's some poor Newsom staffer who's spending hours going through every podcast Larry Elder.
They are.
Totally. Sean, though, I mean, this is a turnout game, right? We saw the UC Berkeley Institute for Governmental Studies poll also out just recently. It noted a big difference between the attitudes of overall voters, which, of course, do lean Democratic and more liberal, and those likely to actually vote. So we're talking 36% of all voters told pollsters they'd vote for the recall, but 47% of likely voters say they'd vote to oust Newsom. I mean, you're plugged in. Like, do you just think Republicans are more motivated, and should Democrats be hitting the panic button?
My belief on this recall was the timing wasn't great insofar as the pandemic was going to be almost gone. Kids were going to be back into school. College football was starting again. People were all going to be happy. And you saw some of that early in the summer where people just felt like they were liberated. But I will tell you, I think the mood has darkened considerably. So you've got the Delta variant again. You've got masks in seven Bay Area counties. It's probably going to be the state. The governor's going to be fighting with the teachers unions about whether kids go back into school or not, which affects parents' ability to go to work now. You've got, I just think, filth in the streets in San Francisco and Los Angeles. You've got chronic homelessness issues. Crime has exploded. And how many more videos do we need to see? They're not even running out of the Walgreens or the Neiman Marcuses anymore. In LA, they're just literally walking out of the TJ Maxx. I think those are devastating indictments on the quality of life in California. And that's a real problem. So you can demonize Larry Elder, you can demonize Mr. Cox, you can demonize Mr. Ose. But the bottom line is, a recall is whether you want to fire the guy who's doing the job and whether you think the guy or gal doing the job is doing it well. And I'm just telling you, things are trending very, very different today than they were a month ago.
All right, Carla, final thought with you. Do you think Democrats maybe made a mistake moving up this recall? And should they be as worried as is there room for Republicans to really get this over the finish line?
Yeah, I mean, I think Republicans are more impassioned. They have that going for them. But Democrats have something big going for them, too. And that is that this is an all male election. They don't have to worry about getting people to the polls, driving people to the polls. Everybody's going to get this ballot and people have to just check the box one way or the other. That is a big advantage for Democrats. And that is going to be their message. And we'll see. I think Sean is right. Crime and homelessness are driving voters. And the Republicans have got to hope that that is going to be a defining issue. But at the same time, it may be just about the math and the and how this election is run. By mail, it's going to be a lot easier for the Democrats, and the Republicans are going to have to deal with that.
That's mail postal service, not mail as in man, although we could say the same thing, really, for both. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Carla Marinucci covers California politics at Politico, where she is senior writer for The Playbook. Sean T. Walsh is a Republican strategist. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Coming up, extreme drought is killing tens of thousands of cows in the Mexican state of Sonora. It's also killing a way of life built over centuries. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Marisa Lagos, sitting in for Madeline Brandt. The Mexican state of Sonora is proud of its cattle ranching culture. It's famous for its carne asada, there's a bull on the state flag, and a decade ago, 80% of Sonora land was used for livestock like cattle. Today, Sonora is in drought and facing a hotter, drier future. The cows are going hungry, tens of thousands are starving to death, farmers are selling their herds, and a way of life that stretches back generations is fading. Kate Linthicum visited Sonora and wrote about the drought and the cattle industry. She's a Mexico City-based correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for being here, Kate.
It's great to be here.
Kate, you did this column one for the Times, and the photographs accompanying your story are just stunning. Cows with rib cages sticking out because they're so thin, skeletons on the ground with their skin still on. And you can see the cattle ranchers themselves, many of them older folks, just looking helpless. Tell us about what you saw and what it was like just seeing that firsthand.
Yeah, I had heard stories, about cattle dying en masse in northern Mexico. But I really wasn't prepared for what it was like just to see that. We landed in Sonora and immediately went out with some cattle ranchers. And it felt kind of like an apocalypse. Like, we just saw all over the place these cows that had just basically starved to death, died where they were standing. And it was extremely eerie and extremely, extremely sad. And especially sad for these, these ranchers who live off of these cows, who live with them, who alongside of them, and who are looking at just a really bleak future without them.
Right. It must be twofold. I mean, it must just be hard to see the animals you care for died to begin with. And then also, obviously, the bigger picture, which is that this is a way of life for these farmers. We have generations living on the land, raising cattle. You write that many people here eat beef for breakfast, lunch and dinner. What did they tell you about the difficult decisions they're facing right now?
Yeah, it's hard to overstate kind of how important red meat is. In northern Mexico, and is particularly to Sonora, which is famous for its carne asadas. Tens of thousands of ranchers live in the state and, make their livelihoods off of this. And so for them, it's just a really, really difficult moment because they are looking at an increasingly, hot, increasingly dry future in Sonora. Climate change estimates suggest that, by the middle of this century, you're going to regularly see temperatures as high as like 122, 130 degrees, and you're going to see 30% less rain. so it's very bad now, but it's clearly just getting worse. So ranchers are kind of trying to come up with these short-term solutions. They're trying to drill wells to grow alfalfa to feed their cows. But groundwater, you know, is also an issue. And so you've got kind of this tension between, you know, people kind of trying to think, how can I survive this year? And then other folks, you know, more sort of environmentalist folks who are saying this is not like a sustainable situation, and we need to radically rethink our state's economy.
Yeah, and I mean, it's maybe more extreme in Sonora, but it's the conversation that we're having here in the Western United States as well, right? I mean, the Central Valley here wasn't filled with almond and pistachio crops. Cows were brought to Sonora by the Spanish some 500 years ago. Why and how did cattle farming become so important in this region, given that cows aren't native to the area?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, ranching really is a product of colonialism in a way. And so you have these Spanish missionaries who set up, you know, their missions in this state, and then introduced, you know, cattle to the indigenous people who lived there. And precisely because it's such an arid state, and always has been, there wasn't a ton of agriculture. So the Spanish, you know, brought the cows literally as meat, as food for, you know, the Spanish settlers who arrived there. And I think what your point about, you know, this being obviously kind of a bigger regional issue is super fascinating. I mean, this Sonoran desert is the same, you know, desert that we have in Arizona, where we're seeing the exact same issues. And I think that idea that this is sort of a borderless issue is really fascinating. And I think there are, you know, obviously going to be like migration consequences in the long term as climate change hits, you know, parts of Mexico and obviously Central America. You know, there are like places, wide swaths of land in this region that are going to be unlivable. And that's going to have a really big impact on things like immigration to the United States.
Absolutely. But you write in this piece, I thought this was such a powerful line, the power of tradition is strong, stronger sometimes than reason. You know, this is a place where there have been droughts before. We've seen, you know, severe droughts, really. Do you think the farmers recognize a larger trend of warming, or are they, as you said, kind of just looking at the short term and trying to get through this year?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, a lot of the people I spoke to didn't know the phrase or didn't use the phrase climate change to describe what's happening. But all of them were able to say, it sure seems like the droughts last longer and are more frequent than when I was a kid, or, you know, than when my grandpa was a kid. So they all know, sort of intuitively, probably even more than a lot of us who don't live so directly kind of off the land, that things are changing. But it is really hard because these are cowboys, you know? I mean, this is like their culture. This is their identity. It's not like there are, you know, programs in the state for like re-educating, right, you know, older cowboys to do other things. I mean, there's certainly not that, we're not at that place. That's not the conversation happening now. It's really more like, can we get loans to these people to, you know, maybe buy more cattle so they can kind of restart their business? So yeah, right now it seems like the conversation, I mean, there are some people who are getting out of the business who have the luxury to do that. And then there are other people I talk to, like, you know, this older guy who's been doing this his whole life, who says, I'm too old to learn to do something else. And it was really poignant because his friend responded, you know, we're going to be here until the last cow dies or until we die.
Wow. And of course, this is a cattle is not the most climate friendly thing to be ranching, right? We know that cows produce methane, and that's a whole part of this conversation, but probably not for these farmers. You mentioned the rancher who told you he's too old to learn something new. Another heartbreaking moment was a rancher who tried to get his weakened cows to stand using a pulley system to hold them upright, which didn't work. Just really heartbreaking. I mean, Do you have any bigger takeaways about our ability to adapt as humans emotionally and mentally to this changing world? I mean, are there any lessons we can take?
It's interesting because climate change is this kind of slower moving thing, or at least it has been up until this point. And I feel like people haven't, you know, been forced to kind of really reckon with it in the way that we had to with the pandemic, for example. We immediately shut down global air traffic and, you know, industry, you know, in the face of the pandemic. And we haven't done that in the face of climate change, even though that's what's required. But I do think as we start to see these kind of more dramatic signs of climate change, that I imagine that we're going to have kind of more radical responses. And I guess the question is, you know, will it be enough or will it be too late?
Yeah. Kate Linthicum is a Mexico City-based correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. You can find her work there. I highly encourage our listeners to check it out. Thanks for joining us, Kate.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, Honey Mahogany is the first Black and first trans person to lead the San Francisco Democratic Party.
Yeah, just existing as a drag queen performing is, I think, a form of rebellion and a form of protest.
Mahogany tells us her priorities for her new job. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brandt. For some listeners, the name Honey Mahogany may ring a bell because of this.
My name is Honey Mahogany. People get down on San Francisco for being a bunch of hippies, but there's so much beauty there. Have you seen Honey Mahogany?
Honey Mahogany! The time has come. Get your lip sync for your life.
Drag queen and activist Honey Mahogany was featured on the television show RuPaul's Drag Race back in 2013. Although she didn't win her season, she did win a different type of race recently. This year, Mahogany was elected local party chair of the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee by her fellow committee members. That election makes her the first Black and the first trans person to ever chair the committee. She's also the first trans chair for any U.S. local Democratic Party at a time when trans rights have become a hot-button political issue in many conservative states. And Honey Mahogany joins me now to discuss her plans for her new positions. Hey, Honey.
Hey, it's always good to talk to you.
Yes, I'm very happy to have you here. So I mentioned up there that you are a performer. You did drag for many years and even competed on TV. How much do you see politics as another type of performance?
Oh my goodness, that is a great question. Well, first of all, shout out to that reel that you played, bringing back all my joy and trauma from season 5 of RuPaul's Drag Race. But I, you know, in reality.
Sorry about the trauma part, but you know.
No, it's all good. I think that politics does have a lot to do with performance. I mean, I think that a good politician is able to reflect back the values and the needs of their constituents. And so I think that's, you know, basically what acting is. And, you know, there's this element of it that sometimes I think feels a little Teflon, a little fake, but I actually think that there is a real, I think, deep connection and artistry, and like digging deep when you are an actor, you know, and when you're performing, you really have to connect to real emotions. So I don't think it's superficial at all. And I think that also comes into play when you're a politician. You have to really listen to people and be able to communicate with them, understand them, and then help them by creating policy and change.
And I think for people who may not be familiar with the drag world, I mean, that itself is a political sphere, right? It seems like it's one of the things that brought you into more traditional politics was that element of it.
I guess so. I mean, I never thought of drag, I guess, as political when I started. When I started, it was really just about me, like exploring my gender and gender identity and, you know, performing and doing things that I love. But then, you know, I quickly learned that it was in fact political. I mean, I think gender in general is very political, and that goes, you know, way, way back to the dawn of time even. But I think drag has always been linked to activism and pushing back, specifically within the LGBT community, because, you know, it's kind of hard to hide drag queens, right? I mean, we are very visible. And I think historically speaking, there's been a lot of pushback specifically around gender roles and the ways in which people conform to gender. And so the people who were oftentimes arrested by the police or discriminated against were often the drag queens or the femme people. And so, yeah, just existing as a drag queen performing is, I think, a form of rebellion and a form of protest.
Well, and of course, the identity sort of wrapped up in all of that has become so much of a political issue itself, this time of anti-trans, anti-LGBTQ laws, bathroom bills, healthcare restrictions. Do you see your election to the local party as a kind of counter to some of those efforts?
I think so. I mean, I think that we as a Democratic Party have, you know, had the opportunity to really bring folks in. And, you know, as the Republican Party has continued to get more and more insane and, you know, really sort of ostracize itself and discriminate against more and more communities and double down, you know, the Democratic Party has really had an opportunity, I think, to say, okay, well, we're not that. And here is who we are. And here is who we are bringing in. And here is who we are uplifting and why. And so, you know, I think along with, you know, the protests that happened following the, you know, the murder of George Floyd and just this time that I think we've had as a country to really, you know, look inside and reflect has also made us realize how important it is to center the voices of those who are most marginalized and most impacted by these systems of oppression that we've been carrying on our backs. So I think that, yeah, people are looking towards the leadership of more women, more people of color, more queer people, and more trans people. So I think it, you know, is kind of a perfect storm.
Yeah. One element of the sort of LGBTQ community that we've seen really struggling to continue to exist, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, is the entertainment community, which has been such an important space for both the entertainment, but also for organizing and finding community. You are actually the co-owner of the oldest queer bar in San Francisco. It's called The Stud. It closed down its doors during the pandemic, but this group, this collective, is trying to find a new home. Can you talk a little about where that's at and just the challenges queer spaces like The Stud have faced over the last couple of years?
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that really got me involved in politics was organizing around the displacement of queer venues and queer people from San Francisco. You know, as the city continues to gentrify, you know, as more and more moneyed interests continue to move into San Francisco, right? This is sort of a tale as old as time, but, you know, poor people, people of color, and queer people have continued to be pushed out. And so, you know, The Stud was a sort of a victim of that whole process as rents began to rise. You know, we just weren't making enough money to keep up with rent for a really long time. But basically, we were threatened with closure. And, you know, the people who owned the building wanted to do something else with it. So we had to find a new space anyway. Right now, we are still looking for spaces. You know, things haven't really gotten that much cheaper in San Francisco. And unfortunately, you know, we really want to stay in SoMa, which is the south of Market area, which is historically where The Stud has been and for the last 50 years. And it's also an important corner of the leather LGBTQ community of San Francisco. And the spaces here are really small and really expensive. And so it makes it hard for us to really carve out a future for ourselves here. But I will say that we are hopeful. We are currently exploring options and yeah, The Stud will be back.
So we're talking, you know, from the LA radio market, of course, but there are a lot of parallels between LA and the Bay Area. One of them is the housing crisis, unfortunately, especially homelessness, unhoused residents. What do you see the sort of role of major cities like LA and San Francisco to actually tackle this? And how can the party help?
You know, the party is really here to help guide voters, you know, register Democrats, endorse ballot measures and policy ideas. So in that way, I think that what we can do is really look at how we can support legislation that provides permanent supportive housing for folks. And then how do we provide solutions for the people who are here while we're waiting to build that permanent supportive housing? And I should say permanent supportive affordable housing, right? We need all different kinds of housing. Affordable housing, also middle income housing, I think there's a huge deficit for middle income housing in San Francisco. So we have in the past really advocated for and pushed for the building of, for example, teachers' housing in San Francisco. You know, we're also pushing for things like the implementation of safe use sites or safe injection sites for people who are, you know, in the thralls of drug addiction. You know, we want to be able to provide them again with low barrier entry into programs and then be able to offer them the resources that they need, as well as, you know, take them off of the street and get them, you know, someplace clean and safe. We're also investing a lot here in San Francisco in more community policing, you know, having more resources to offer people, having an ability to keep eyes on people, but also offer people help when they're ready to receive it, I think is really going to be key in terms of getting folks off the street.
All right, well, let's move on to the elephant in the room, the recall election looming over California right now. This is going to happen next month, September 14th, and recent polling is showing it's a lot closer than Newsom and Democrats like yourself would probably like. And the main challenge seems to be for recall opponents is motivating voters who actually like Newsom to come out. It seems like the opponents of the governor are far more motivated. What are you doing at the local level? What is the state party doing? What needs to happen for Democrats to defend the seat?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the state party is very much concerned with this, and I'm taking this very seriously. They have engaged us in basically organizing a lot of phone banks. I mean, right now there isn't as much emphasis on door knocking just because of the pandemic, but we are doing weekly phone banks through the Democratic Party. We're working with our chartered clubs. And then we're also working with our allies in labor to really get out the word and make sure that people know that it is important to vote. Because when you look at the majority of folks across the state, I think a majority of folks actually oppose the recall, but it's those people who are most likely to vote where it's a little bit tighter, right? I think Governor Newsom has a slight lead in preventing the recall, but it's just a few percentage points of likely voters.
All right, final question, honey. Progressives like yourself have a long list of things they want to do, right? We're talking about tackling climate change, universal preschool and childcare, ending homelessness. But, you know, we're in a state where Democrats have held the governor's office for a decade, have had a supermajority in the state legislature for several years, and those dreams are still pretty far off. Why not give the other side a chance? Like, what's the argument here?
Why not give? What does that even mean?
Well, we have a bunch of Republicans trying to, oust the governor. I mean, what is the Democrats' message that they should stay in control when I think the Republicans would say you all own these problems?
Well, I would say that, you know, the California state legislature is actually quite diverse. Yes, it's majority Democrats, but a lot of those Democrats, I do think, come from more conservative areas where Republicans do have a firm hold and a voice. So I would say that progressive values haven't really been given a chance. I think that there is, you know, a struggle within the Democratic Party itself, right, of more traditionalists, and then more people like me who I think a little more progressive, who would like to see, you know, universal health care and who would like to see all of those things that you talked about. I do think that younger people also believe in a lot of these same things and are pushing for that. And I think we will see a swing to the left within the Democratic Party over the next couple of years. In fact, I think if we, God willing, knock on wood, we survive this recall, I think that Governor Newsom is actually going to owe a lot to progressives who really rallied the troops and helped turn out that vote. And so hopefully he will take that seriously and really come through on a lot of his promises.
That's Honey Mahogany, chair of the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee. Thanks, Honey.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Rihanna officially joined the Billionaires Club, making her the second richest woman in entertainment. And she did it with beauty and fashion lines that prioritize inclusivity. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Marisa Lagos, filling in for Madeline Brand. Rihanna has joined the Billionaires Club. Forbes estimates her net worth to be $1.7 billion, making her the richest woman in music and the second richest woman in entertainment, behind Oprah, of course. She's known for her hits like Umbrella, Work, and We Found Love. But didn't come from the music. It came from her business ventures in beauty and fashion. Back in 2017, Rihanna launched Fenty Beauty, a makeup line that debuted with 40 shades of foundation. A year later, she launched Savage X Fenty, an inclusive lingerie line for people of all sizes. Joining us now to talk about Rihanna's career and success is Omi Shayke Tinsley. She's a professor of Black Studies at UC Santa Barbara, and in the past, she taught a course called Beyoncé Feminism, Rihanna Womanism. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into Rihanna's business ventures, I wondered if we could talk a little bit about her childhood, because she was certainly not born into this type of money. She was born and raised in Barbados. Can you just tell us a little about her family life was like back then?
She talks quite a lot about being raised primarily by her grandmother. She's from Westbury Road in Bridgetown, which is kind of a regular neighborhood, rum shops and whatnot. She did not come from generational wealth. She did not have all of her family present with her, but she had an upbringing that's not atypical in the Caribbean or in the U.S. South for African American folk. She talks about her grandmother as a force that uplifted her and kept things going, and in the tradition of Black women in the Caribbean from slavery forward.
Yeah, that positive force of the female feminine leadership in the family. I think she calls her grand Dolly.
Yeah.
So Rihanna came to the U.S. when she was just a teenager. What brought her here initially?
Well, she came to do, she ended up rising to fame, working with Jay-Z. Originally, her music had more of a Caribbean flavor than it came to, but she was coming to, people were calling her the West Indian Beyonce when she got here, which she turned out not to be at all.
Totally. So let's talk about this transition, though, from music into business, because we don't have any new Rihanna music. She hasn't put out an album since 2016.
Yeah.
But as we said at the top, her makeup line, Fenty Beauty, has been wildly successful, debuting with 40 shades of foundation. How groundbreaking was this move? Explain it to women who may not have darker skin tones and understand what it was like before the last few years.
What it was like before the last few years. There were some niche brands that were catering to women of color, but really not major makeup brands. And so a lot of us were going into MAC makeup and trying to mix foundations to get our shade. And the idea that you would start out with 40 shades and it wouldn't be like 25 of them are designed for white women. It would be like 40 shades that are designed for 40 different women coming from different racial backgrounds was absolutely earth-shattering. She's now up to 50 shades, and it's really changed the game for a lot of us and made us feel like beauty is ours, right? Beauty comes in our shade. When Rihanna launched the line, which is what I'm wearing today, which is what I'm wearing every day, right? It made me excited to see in the mainstream somebody reflecting back the importance of being able to look in the mirror and feel right in your skin and your shade.
And what a different world for young women of color, particularly Black women growing up now, right? I mean, to have this just available to them as teenagers.
Yes. I mean, my daughter, right? Like, I could buy shades for me and I could buy shades for her. She's a darker skin tone than me. And it was all in the realm of what's beautiful and what's possible and what's accessible, right? Not what is a special niche that you have to work. Like, I love Rihanna's work song, but I'm not trying to work. Right.
Your makeup. Well, it's funny you bring up the mixing of colors because Honey Mahogany, who's a Democratic party official in California we just had on, she got her drag name Honey Mahogany from mixing two CoverGirl shades, she told me in the past. So like, this is not that far in the past. Can we talk about what's different in terms of how Rihanna has kept control and ownership of this company? I think she owns about half of the company. She's not just lending her name, right? Is that also indicative of a new generation of Black businesswomen?
I hope that it is. I think I was joking that Rihanna warned us when she did Bitch Better Have My Money that she was tired of being in industries where she didn't have control over her profits, but also I think where she didn't have control over her product. She took it to the extent that she could. And I think that it's telling that she had to go out. And I'm not mad at her for not, as much as I want her to put out an album, I'm not mad at her for what she's doing, right? Because she has found an industry niche where she could have that creative control that was not possible for her in the music industry, and that we haven't seen be possible before in the beauty industry, really, right? Like, now we have other people following her lead, but for a Black woman to be in control of the vision as well as the profits is really groundbreaking, and I think changes the stage for what people can demand in partnerships.
And this isn't the only successful business venture she's pursued. I've read that one of your favorite topics from your course is her lingerie line, Savage X Fenty. Talk about that. Why do you love this line? And what topics did that bring up in class?
So I was teaching, the last time I taught the course was at Harvard. And that was when the first Savage by Fenty show premiered at New York Fashion Week, right? And it really angered a lot of people, I think, because of the excitement that it garnered. And when I watched it, I was blown away by the vision. I mean, it's really, it's a show, right? It's not people walking down the runway. It's a musical show. It's choreographed. The colors are vibrant and saturated as if to reflect Barbados, but also to reflect women of color and our deeper skin tone, and that she has non-binary folks, that she has Lizzo, right? That she has full-bodied folks, that she has people assigned male at birth, people assigned female at birth, disabled people, pregnant people, right? This is a whole other world from Victoria's Secret Angels that really disrupted Fashion Week. And I think it disrupts what we think of as beautiful. And even though I haven't taught a class on Rihanna, every year I teach Savage by Fenty. And I ask people to think about it in terms of body positivity and what does it bring up in terms of really thinking about what diversity can look like.
Yeah, what a difference from, yeah, the Victoria's Secret that, like, I grew up with seeing on the TV. I mean, you also include Beyonce in the course you used to teach. Can you talk a little bit about what it is about her and Rihanna that you think makes them so influential? Because it's not just that they're pop stars, right? They have such broader cultural influence, and they've been so successful in the business world as well.
Yes. I think I taught that course first at the University of Texas at Austin. And I did that about the time that Beyonce's self-titled album came out. But I saw people wearing shirts like I Woke Up Like This, right, and Flawless, and that there was something about these lyrics that told Black women from Texas that they're important and their voice mattered, and somebody would want to listen to the voice of somebody like them. And also, I wanted to privilege that what Beyonce and Rihanna are saying in their lyrics, especially in their music videos, in Rihanna's case, they have messages, and these are messages about what does it mean to be a complicated and empowered Black and or Caribbean woman in the world, and that this is a way of understanding Black feminism, right, and how it works in your own life. And you don't have to be able to quote Simone de Beauvoir to say you're a feminist. If you're quoting Beyonce and Rihanna, you have an idea about feminism and how it plays in your life.
Absolutely. Well, we will be continuing to watch what they do next. Omi Shekhe Tinsley is a professor of Black Studies at UC Santa Barbara. She also taught a course called Beyonce Feminism, Rihanna Womanism. Thank you so much for your time, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
That does it for us today on Press Play. I'm Risa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand this week. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.